by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Grass makes heaven the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got some good news coming from InfoWars. Alex Jones is announcing that the military has made a major announcement of not interfering whatsoever in the up-and-coming November 3rd election. Here we go with Alex Jones making a very, very updated, good news announcement.
Alex Jones here on this Friday night with some incredibly positive and good news. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the head of the Pentagon, the most senior military officer in the United States, issued a public letter, we now learn, about 5 days ago, to Congress saying the military will not take part in a military coup removing President Trump if there is a contested election. Now, why is this so important? It's unprecedented. Atlantic Monthly and other globalist publications a year ago started talking about canvassing top military officers about removing Trump in a military coup. Now, why would they say that publicly? Because they're normalizing it and testing the waters so people think that that's something that's okay to do when it's absolutely criminal and called high treason against the election of Donald Trump or any other duly elected president. Then we saw Nancy Pelosi and Maxine Waters and Eric Holder, the former attorney general, and Joe Biden. All of them talk about we will escort him from the White House. And I'm very proud of InfoWars. We were the first to point this out over a year ago. We were the first to beat the drum, make a big issue about it. A few months ago, Milley was kind of making cryptic comments about Trump and how he shouldn't be seen with him in public, marching over to the church that was burned. And other top generals were making anti-Trump statements. And we saw that as a nod to the deep state against the president. And so did high-level CIA contacts and others that we have. They agreed. But now, because it's clear that Trump's going to win in a landslide, now that the riots the deep state have engineered have backfired, now that the attempts by Soros to plunge the dollar have failed so far, 65 days out from the election, things are really solidifying behind Trump. Now, I told you Trump was going to win before anybody else did 5-6 years ago, right before he even announced. I said it'll probably be Trump and he'll probably be the leader. And about a year out from the election, I said he was going to happen, populism, because globalism's in trouble all over the world. So we're not out of the woods yet. They're putting out 80 million ballots mailed randomly around to gum up the system to contest the election. But they were, again, asking the military brass, canvassing them, will you go along with us if we start having states secede and if we start calling for Trump to be removed, will you take him out? Even the New York Times a month ago had an article about John Podesta, Tony Podesta's brother, the former head of the Clinton campaign, saying, we're going to have states pull out, say that Trump lost, say that Biden won, have our own inauguration, and we'll hold the stock market and the dollar hostage, and we believe the military will step in and take Trump out. That was in the New York Times a month ago. Breitbart also reported on it. So they've been normalizing all of this, and it's failed, and now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has come out in a statement military-wide and to Congress saying, that's not our role, it's unconstitutional, we will not do it. He responded last week when two senior Democrats on the Armed Services Committee in the House sent him a letter saying, help us do this. So that's how far along they were normalizing this with Pelosi and Hillary and all the rest of them saying, we're going to contest no matter what happens. They know they're losing. And we're going to say it's illegitimate and we're going to have states break away and cause a new civil war. And they're trying to see if the modern, I guess, Robert E. Lee is going to be the, leader of the Northern Army or whatever. But it's the Democrats again that are trying to break the country up. This is history repeating itself. It is insane. but this is incredibly good news. Now, a lot of you have already seen these clips. We've been beating this drum hard for over a year. But we're going to play some of these clips of Biden, of Pelosi, of Hillary Clinton just last week saying we're going to contest no matter what. And they're still going to try this. They've got other tricks up their sleeves. But they thought Trump and America would get blamed for the race riots they engineered. They thought that the bad economy and the COVID hoax would get blamed on Trump. People are seeing through it. So we got to really watch now. What's the deep state going to pull? So again, this is a time to be very, very pleased, very, very thankful to God, but to redouble our efforts to make sure this big win happens, keep Bolsonaro in Brazil, keep Patriots in the UK, and expand 1776 worldwide. But the military refused to be part of the coup. CNN tried to spin it. Top U.S. general tells Congress the military won't play a role in 2020 election, but it's all in the article, his letter, everything, admitting that they asked him, will you be part of removing Trump physically? And they said, not just no, hell no, it's illegal. Again, I'm Alex Jones. This is the InfoWar. Thank you so much for your support, Patriots. Without you, this broadcast would not be here. And this broadcast always covers the hard subjects first when others won't talk about it. It sounded crazy 14 months ago to say they're planning a military coup, they're canvassing the military, but they were doing it. We had to put it out there, warn people, watch folks get aware of it, and then the Democrats came and tried to push the plan, and people went, whoa, this is all true. We've got to fight it. So you've got to get out ahead of this stuff or they're going to win. And more you're out ahead of it. So supporting band.video, InfoWars.com, NewsWars.com has changed the world. You guys are really, really amazing. Thank you so much for tuning in. And spread the word about our new nighttime show that a lot of you are watching right now, 7 to 9 p.m. Election Countdown, Taking Back America. And tonight it is Harrison Smith and others hosting. Donna Lorraine will be back next week along with Owen Shorter and so many others. I'll be doing a special transmission tomorrow, 2 to 4 p.m. commercial free on all the InfoWars streams, covering the latest news, and Sundays, 4 to 6 p.m. I've been doing that for a long time. Now Owen does Sunday Live after me, 6 to 8 Central. And again, it's commercial free in that we run some network commercials for local stations. We keep those for them, but we don't have any of our commercials. All right, again, thank you so much for watching. Spread the word about this. This is another big story we broke first. We forced out in the open before they tried it, and then right on time they tried it, and it got rejected because we didn't get caught with our pants down. They got caught with their pants down. So good for General Milley and others getting on the right side of history. God bless you all, and God bless America.
You know, Joe Biden should not concede under any circumstances, because I think this is going to drag out. And eventually, I do believe he will win if we don't give an inch and if we are as focused and relentless as the other side is.
The fact is, whether he knows it yet or not, he will be leaving. Just because he might not want to move out of the White House doesn't mean we won't have an inauguration ceremony to inaugurate a duly elected president of the United States. But there is a process. It has nothing to do with if the certain occupant of the White House doesn't feel like moving and has to be fumigated out of there, because the presidency is the presidency. It's not geography or location.
It has been suggested that this is a trial run for the President of the United States, who may be organizing to not accept what happens when we have the election. If he's not elected, is he going to pull out his military? Is he going to engage us? He has already alluded to there may be a civil war if he's not reelected. This is dangerous. We are trying to find out more about it.
And sadly, the domestic enemies to our voting system and our honoring our Constitution are right at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It's really actually shameful. Enemies of the state.
He's talking about sending these unmarked paramilitary guards to places with Democratic and blue states with very blue cities run by Democratic mayors. I think we should all take very seriously the prospect that this is, as I say, a dress rehearsal, a trial run for first an attempt at voter intimidation on Election Day. Are these unmarked paramilitary units going to be doing security at the polls in battleground states? I think that's a question we'd like to have answered.
Are you concerned about that these paramilitary forces will be used to suppress the vote using intimidation and fear?
I mean, if you'd ask me that question about any other president, I would say, of course not. That's, you know, the script from a very bad movie. But this administration, this president has demonstrated that they have a capacity to go lower than we can even possibly imagine. So, yeah, I think we have to be concerned about that. His attempt to talk about mail-in voting and all the fraud that is associated with it is factually incorrect. He's just trying to set up a situation where he has the ability to delegitimize a vote that he might lose. If he loses, and I expect that he will, then we have to be prepared for what he is going to do in the immediate aftermath of such a loss and what he'll do for the time period between the election and the inauguration of the next president. We have to be prepared for things that this nation has never faced before. And unfortunately, that could involve the use of, you know, these forces. Who knows what he'll do, and the people who are in, as part of his administration will support him in doing.
This president's going to try to steal this election. This is the guy who said that all mail-in ballots are fraudulent.
Have you ever considered what would happen if the election results came out as you being the winner and Trump refused to leave?
Yes, I have. I was so damn proud. You have four chiefs of staff coming out and ripping the skin off of Trump. And you have so many rank and file military personnel saying, whoa, we're not a military state. This is not who we are. I promise you, I'm absolutely convinced they will escort him from the White House with great dispatch.
Notice those statements were made by Democrats, and they're all coming together to try to plant the idea in the American mind that this election will not be a fair election, and that if Trump is a winner of it, they should dispute it. And they're organizing now. Someone said hundreds of attorneys are organizing a movement to question and to dispute the results of the election, especially if Trump wins. But here we go next with the president, and this is just a small piece of his acceptance speech. And at the White House on Thursday evening. Here we go now with President Trump.
My fellow Americans, tonight with a heart full of gratitude and boundless optimism, I profoundly accept this nomination for President of the United States. The Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, goes forward united, determined, and ready to welcome millions of Democrats, independents, and anyone who believes in the greatness of America and the righteous heart of the American people. In a new term as president, we will again build the greatest economy in history, quickly returning to full employment, soaring incomes, and record prosperity. We will defend America against all threats and protect America against all dangers. We will lead America into new frontiers of ambition and discovery. And we will reach for new heights of national achievement. We will rekindle new faith in our values, new pride in our history, and a new spirit of unity that can only be realized through love for our great country. Because we understand that America is not a land cloaked in darkness. America is the torch that enlightens the entire world. Gathered here at our beautiful and majestic White House, known all over the world as the People's House, we cannot help but marvel at the miracle that is our great American story. This has been the home of larger-than-life figures like Teddy Roosevelt and Andrew Jackson, who rallied Americans to bold visions of a bigger and brighter future. Within these walls lived tenacious generals like President Grant and Eisenhower, who led our soldiers in the cause of freedom. From these grounds, Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark on a daring expedition to cross a wild and uncharted continent. In the depths of a bloody civil war, President Abraham Lincoln looked out these very windows upon a half-completed Washington Monument and asked God in his providence to save our nation. 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt welcomed Winston Churchill, and just inside, they set our people on a course to victory in the Second World War. In recent months, our nation and the entire planet has been struck by a new and powerful invisible enemy. Like those brave Americans before us, we are meeting this challenge. We are delivering life-saving therapies and will produce a vaccine before the end of the year, or maybe even sooner. We will defeat the virus, end the pandemic, and emerge stronger than ever before. What united generations past was an unshakable confidence in America's destiny and an unbreakable faith in the American people. They knew that our country is blessed by God and has a special purpose in this world. It is that conviction that inspired the formation of our Union, our westward expansion, the abolition of slavery, the passage of civil rights, the space program, and the overthrow of fascism, tyranny, and communism. This towering American spirit has prevailed over every challenge and lifted us to the summit of human endeavor. And yet, despite all of our greatness as a nation, everything we have achieved is now in danger. This is the most important election in the history of our country. Thank you. At no time before have voters faced a clearer choice between two parties, two visions, two philosophies, or two agendas. This election will decide whether we save the American dream or whether we allow a socialist agenda to demolish our cherished destiny. It will decide whether we rapidly create millions of high-paying jobs or whether we crush our industries and send millions of these jobs overseas, as has foolishly been done for many decades. Your vote will decide whether we protect law-abiding Americans or whether we give free rein to violent anarchists and agitators and criminals who threaten our citizens. And this election will decide whether we will defend the American way of life or whether we will allow a radical movement to completely dismantle and destroy it. That won't happen. At the Democrat National Convention, Joe Biden and his party repeatedly assailed America as a land of racial, economic, and social injustice. So tonight I ask you a simple question. How can the Democrat Party ask to lead our country when it spends so much time tearing down our country? In the left's backward view, they do not see America as the most free, just, and exceptional nation on earth. Instead, they see a wicked nation that must be punished for its sins. Our opponents say that redemption for you can only come from giving power to them. This is a tired anthem spoken by every repressive movement throughout history. But in this country, we don't look to career politicians for salvation. In America, we don't turn to government to restore our souls. We put our faith in Almighty God.
Boy, that was quite a speech. I'll have a click off on thesecrettruth.com site where you can go and listen to his whole speech. Coming up next is Mark Levin interviewed William Barr, and Barr had some very, very insightful things to say about Antifa, about the guerrilla, the new guerrilla warfare that is being waged by these different groups out there. But anyway, this is a very, very insightful interview clip from William Barr and Mark Levin. Here we go next.
Are you shocked what's going on with police forces in this country? The brazen attack on police officers by Antifa and Black Lives Matter and other revolutionary groups, and the failure of local politicians to whom they report to protect them and defend them and protect and defend the citizens of these communities? Is this not shocking?
It is shocking. You know, even before the events in Minneapolis, I was speaking, since I became Attorney General again, about how in a full employment economy, which we did have and we will have again, that we have to be careful because policing is becoming a very difficult and dangerous job, and you have to, in order to attract the best people there, you have to be supportive of them. And I was worried about the vacancy rates and the fact it's hard to keep police in many of our major cities. And then we had this turn of events where they've been demonized. The fact is, generally speaking, we have superb police in this country, very professional forces. And, you know, these events do happen. We have over 600,000 police in this country, and there will be some instances of excessive force. But by and large, it's an excellent police force, and if they're going to be demonized like this, they're not going to work in these cities. So maybe there'll be a self-correcting mechanism. If communities don't support the police, they're going to have a hard time getting police.
And they're going to depopulate these communities. They're going to leave. Governor Cuomo the other day was begging millionaires and billionaires to stay in New York City. I don't think cooking dinner for them is going to, right. It's going to replace safety. Let me read right. something to you. Gatestone Institute, International Policy, about Antifa. I don't think people really understand Antifa. And they say, empirical and anecdotal evidence shows that Antifa is in fact highly networked, well-funded, has a global presence. It is a flat organizational structure with dozens and possibly hundreds of local groups. And by the way, the oldest group is in Portland. They say Antifa's stated long-term objective, both in America and abroad, and it got its birth in Europe, England, then Germany, then the United States, is to establish a communist world order. And by the way, this information is put out. It's not like we're conspiracy theorists or so forth. In the United States, Antifa's immediate aim is to bring down the demise of the Trump administration. It's an attack on capitalism. They say they're attacking fascism when they're Marxist fascists, such thing. To bring down the Trump administration. It's interesting that one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter said that one of her focuses is to bring down the Trump administration. What is it about the Trump administration that stands in their way?
Well, I think they would be, you know, generally for bringing down any administration. They are a revolutionary group that is interested in some form of socialism, communism. They're essentially Bolsheviks. Their tactics are fascistic. And your description of them is consistent with what I've seen. With the Trump administration, you know, a lot of it has been the demonization of the Trump administration from day one. I went back and I watched his victory speech after election night. People should go back and look at it. It was very measured. It was a very statesmanlike speech. He offered the olive branch. He praised Hillary Clinton, thanked her for all her service to the country, talked about working together to make things better for the American people. That was the day he won, and from that point forward, there's been the resistance. They were trying to impeach him from day one. They have done everything they can. They've shredded the norms of our system to do what they can to drive him from office or to debilitate his administration. And I think it's because of the desire for power, that the left wants power because that is essentially their state of grace in their secular religion. They want to run people's lives so they can design utopia for all of us. And that's what, you know, that's what turns them on. And it's the lust for power. And they weren't expecting Trump's victory, and it outrages them.
In this document, this research, they talk about the roots of Antifa in the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany and other really violent radical organizations in the United States, similar to the Black Panthers, similar to the Weather Underground, except they're more networked, they're better organized. They seem to have more ammunition of sorts to use against police officers and so forth. And apparently they get a lot of their funding online. I have to believe that that our agencies and so forth are really trying to construct some kind of scenario about what we're dealing with and how to undo this. Am I close?
It's a form it's a new form of urban guerrilla warfare. You know, Mao Tse Tung used to speak about the guerrilla being like fish swimming in the ocean, the way the guerrilla moves through the people. The guerrilla hides out among the people as a fish in the ocean. And what they do is they are essentially shielding themselves or shrouding themselves in First Amendment activity. They go into the demonstrations, which are exercising First Amendment activity, and they insinuate themselves in there to shield themselves. That's where they swim. And what they do is they hijack these demonstrations, and they provoke violence, and they have various tiers of people from the sort of top provocateurs down through people who are their minions and sort of run the violent missions. But it's a difficult phenomenon to deal with. They're highly organized at these demonstrations, and these tactics that they use are designed, and the way the media responds to them, of course. The media doesn't take footage of what's happening. They don't take the footage of the rocks being thrown.
Well, I tell you what, Bill Maher said it like it was. The next clip is a Black Lives Matter spokesman in Chicago saying some very, very insightful things about the mayor and so forth. But here we go with this clip from Black Lives Matter representative spokesman in Chicago.
In the past 2 months, three of my sisters, my friends, have been arrested and brutalized by the Chicago Police Department. Our mayor has said nothing about it. Our black, gay mayor is not protecting the black women in this city. I have a personal problem with that. Alicia was arrested during the first protest downtown. Miracle had her teeth knocked out of her mouth. Alicia was thrown on the ground and beaten by several officers. These are women that we are talking about. These are women that are not committing any crimes except for exercising their First Amendment right to speak their voice. We're speaking out against injustice, systemic racism, police brutality. We're sick of our brothers and our sisters dying in our communities. And the only thing that the mayor can do is sick her dogs on us is beat us, is arrest us, is steal our lives from us. She's cut off the north side, completely cut off the north side. Let's just talk about the simple ways that we're being disserviced. Because all of the exits are blocked off on any given day, it takes an hour and 30 minutes to get from the south side of Chicago to the west side of Chicago on the expressway. You are creating problems in black and brown communities to protect white people, and it shows. Like, we see you. We really see you for who you are. You're not fooling anybody. The answer to people fighting against the policies that you are putting in place is not to rob them of their right to vote, Lori. You can't just throw felonies on everybody for speaking their mind. Shadrick has not been processed. He has not been released. We've been here for 12 plus hours, and she still has said nothing. Nothing to the community, nothing to the black organizers who were brutalized. We haven't heard anything. This is unacceptable. This is our city. And we're taking this shit back, point blank, period. End of discussion. We have demands, and they need to be met. And I feel like I've been saying this too much. We're not asking you anything. We're telling you what's about to happen with your permission or not. I don't want to come out here again. I don't want to have to do this again. I don't want to take a day. I unfortunately was not at the action yesterday. I was actually taking a day between this organizing because it's taxing work, because we are kids trying to grow up. And I took a day to myself to wake up to find out that my friends are being abused by the fucking police. You can listen to us, or you can get ran over. And that's all I have to say.
This is getting more and more paralyzed and getting more and more divisive. And I just hope and pray that we can try to bring this thing back together. We've got a couple of clips from Tucker Carlson's program coming up. One is from a reporter that's been at most of these different disputes, demonstrations, and so forth in violence-prone cities. I think he's been in Seattle and Portland, Minneapolis, and now in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And he's interesting in what he has comparisons a little bit. But he says Kenosha, he says the worst one is Minneapolis, and because of the size of it, of the violence and so forth. He said Kenosha is the second. But anyway, listen to this with Julio Rosas and Tucker Carlson. Here we go next.
So riots across the country for the last 3 months raise the question, why do we have police? Well, we hire cops to clean up the messes the rest of us create. When people don't get married before they have kids and their fatherless sons turn violent, or when big business offshores blue-collar jobs and entire communities collapse, it is the police who deal with the consequences. Not all cops are good at their jobs, obviously. But in the end, the big problems are not their fault. Most of them are just working class guys doing their best. Unfortunately for them, working class guys are Donald Trump's base. And the Democratic Party hates them for that, particularly in an election year. So to neutralize them, the left has constructed an absurd, a baseless but elaborate lie designed to convince you that the police are the real problem in this country. Amazingly, an awful lot of people have fallen for it. That's why there are no cops around anymore. The result of that? Chaos. Dozens dead. Kids in the streets with guns. America's cities on fire. Why did that happen? Because the left neutered the police. That's why it happened. None of these cities looked like this 3 months ago. Not until they did this. The consequences are their fault. They're not your fault. They're not the fault of the police. They're the fault of the academic left that made this possible across the country. Kenosha, Wisconsin is the latest place it's happened. Here's some of what happened in that city this week.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
Thank you.
So who did that? Who turned a nice little town like Kenosha, Wisconsin, into a hellscape where 17-year-olds are shooting people? You didn't do that. The cops didn't do that. The left did that. They destroyed that city. They abetted the violence you saw the other night. Period. They made the cops go away, and when the cops left, lunacy filled the void. Period. They're denying that now, but they're lying, as usual. The media didn't even want to cover it. Mostly they didn't. So the job of covering the riots fell to people like Julio Rosas. He's a senior writer at Town Hall. He was there. He joins us for an update on what's happened in Kenosha. Julio, thanks so much for coming on. So what's the state of the city tonight?
So I flew out of Kenosha this morning, and last night was largely peaceful. There were still gatherings past curfew, and they had a march. They marched throughout the street, but I didn't see any confrontations between officers or protesters or even armed civilians, as unfortunately we saw Tuesday night. And so I think that was the result of Trump sending in more reinforcements, and because people seemingly are more scared after the multiple shootings that happened on Tuesday.
So from our perspective and in talking to others who were there, it looks like predictably violence filled the void left by legitimate law enforcement. There was no one around to keep order, so of course violence exploded. Was that your impression being there?
Absolutely. I mean, this could have been stopped on Monday night because the rioting broke out on Sunday. And instead of asking for the reinforcements necessary, the police and were mostly kept to protect the county courthouse and the precinct. And so that left the rest of the downtown area at the mercy of rioters. And multiple buildings were burned. A lot of property was damaged. They particularly were like to target parking lots filled with cars. And so and then we saw that again a little bit on Tuesday night. And I was only a few feet away from the site of the second shooting. And it was just chaos. It was absolute anarchy. And so, I mean, this is really the result of poor leadership at both the local and the state level.
Of course it is. It looks scary as hell from the pictures, was it?
As you know, Tucker, I've been traveling all across the country, Minneapolis, Seattle, Portland, yes. Los Angeles, New York, and this was second to Minneapolis. And the only reason why Minneapolis is still number one in my book is just because of how large scale. It was on a much yeah. bigger scale, but Kenosha, of all places, it turns out to be number two in my book in terms of just absolute anarchy.
Of all places, exactly. Thanks so much for that. I appreciate it. I'm glad you're safe.
Thank you, Tucker.
Coming up is another clip by an eyewitness, McGinnis. And he's interviewed by Tucker Carlson. And this eyewitness actually was trying to render help to the fellow that was shot. I think Rittenhouse was involved in this particular shooting. And so he gives some very eyewitness, insightful first person there on the scene. He says there were shots fired before Rittenhouse fired his shots. He doesn't know exactly all the details, but listen closely to what he has to say. And Tucker Carlson's really bringing out and trying to introduce to the public a more unbiased view of these incidents. And it's unfortunate that a young man died there, and we just don't know all the details yet. But anyway, listen to this eyewitness account. More and more will come out later, and we'll know more about it. So here we go now with some eyewitness.
Well, prosecutors have charged 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse with murder. Two people were shot during the riots this week. One of the people who was there right at the scene, in fact, no one was closer, was Richie McGinnis of the Daily Caller. Richie McGinnis was almost hit by a gunshot at one point. He was a critical witness to what has become a very controversial crime. He joins us tonight for details on what he saw. Richie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So we spoke to you the other day, but didn't quite understand just how close you were to this shooting. It turns out there may have been gunshots fired before the one that killed Joseph Rosenberg. Tell us what you saw.
Well, Tucker, I was just about 10 or 12 feet behind them as they ran into the parking lot. And what I saw was Rosenbaum pursuing Rittenhouse. And Rittenhouse turned around. Now, right before he turned around, I'm not sure if this was a reason why he turned around, but there was a gunshot, and that's actually visible on video. It's not clear whether or not that gunshot was fired into the air or towards Rittenhouse, but Rittenhouse did turn around immediately after that. And at that point, he went from running away to aiming his weapon at Rosenbaum, and I was actually directly behind Rosenbaum. So I took one or two steps to my right as Rosenbaum was lunging for the barrel of the rifle, and he was that close to him. And Rittenhouse actually took the barrel of the rifle and just dodged around. And at that point, as Rosenbaum was falling forward, he fired quickly four shots into Rosenbaum. And at that point, I was only about 12, maybe 15 feet behind them, and I saw Rosenbaum fall to the ground. And at that point, my concern, as I saw Rittenhouse run away, was to provide whatever aid I could to the man who I just saw gravely injured directly in front of me. And what I didn't realize until after, when I reviewed the video footage, is that when Rittenhouse ran away, he actually ran around the car and back up behind me. And I was kneeled on the ground over Rosenbaum. He was face down, and I was preparing to find out where the bullet holes were when a pair of legs arrived next to me, and I just saw the legs. I didn't see anything else. And I said, "What are you doing? Call 911. And I saw that individual grab the phone and put it up to their head. And I only found out later that that was actually Rittenhouse himself, who had just shot Rosenbaum. And soon after that, he ran away, and a bunch of other individuals arrived. We did our best to plug whatever wounds we saw, and somebody said that the hospital was just across the street. So I slung Rosenbaum's arm over my shoulder, his right arm. Another individual took his left, and then some others took his legs, and one other man was holding my shirt, actually, on his head. And we took him to the hospital as quickly as we could.
And he died.
And he died.
But shots were fired before Rittenhouse fired. The guy he shot was trying to pull his gun out of his hands. And then we learn that another man he shot in the arm had a handgun in his hand running at him with that. With the gun in his hand. Has that man been charged for attempted murder, do you know?
Not that I know of, Tucker, but I did see that man actually in the hospital shortly after I arrived. He came through the emergency room waiting room with a couple of police officers, and I saw his arm. And obviously, you can take a look at the damage. I won't describe it on television, but it was gruesome.
Yeah. There's a lot about this story that bears no resemblance whatsoever to the story that we're reading in the newspapers, and since you are, to my knowledge, the most knowledgeable person about what happened, since we're standing right there, I'm grateful that you came on tonight. Richard McGinnis, thank you from the
Daily Call. Thank you for having me.
We're just trying to get down to this. Coming up next, the truth it is, I mean, how hard is it to achieve sometimes? Coming up next is an eyewitness account from Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky, junior senator, and his wife, Kelly, about how they were mobbed right after Thursday night, after the President Trump's acceptance speech there at the White House. And this got dangerous. We've got to take note of what's going on in this country. Here we go by Fox and Friends of a live interview with Rand Paul.
You can tell that man behind the mask is Rand Paul. A bunch of protesters descending on the Kentucky senator and his wife Kelly as they left the Senate, the president's RNC speech from the White House. Actually, it was a longer trip than that. He joins us right now for his first live interview since that confrontation. Senator, good morning. That looks scary.
Good morning. Yeah, you know, my wife and I, it was horrific. You know, we had two women with us who were friends of ours. We had looked out, you know, we came out of the speech
at the White House.
We looked into the street. Our hotel was only right across the street from the White House, but we couldn't go because the mob was already chasing people down that chose to go out that exit. So the Secret Service says, get on a bus and ride to the Trump Hotel. So we got on a bus. It took 45 minutes to get through all the mobs. We get there safely, and then we say we'll get an Uber to go all the way back where we came from, and we wanted to be dropped off at the hotel. But as we got close to it, the streets were blocked and no one would let us through. And what happened is there was two blocks, and I regret that I made this decision, but I said we're going to walk the two blocks. We walked one block. But as we walked one block, we could see some police in the distance, but we also saw a mob of about 30 people marching and yelling. They all of a sudden saw me right as we got to the policeman, fortunately, or I don't think we'd have survived. We got to the policeman, and the policeman, I don't think, recognized me. And as they came closer, they were shouting my name, and the crowd doubled to 60. Mm-hmm. And then it doubled again to 120. And as they were surrounding us, and it got closer and closer, and everybody kept pushing back, the policemen were forming a barricade with their bodies. I whispered to the policeman, "They know who I am. You've got to get reinforcements. It's going to get worse." He called for reinforcements, but we didn't get any reinforcements. We waited, but the crowd was getting bigger and bigger and pushing in. They were yelling threats. They were trying to push the police over to get to me. They were grabbing at us. And it got worse and worse and worse. And then finally we decided to make a move. I said, we've got to move. If there's not going to be reinforcements, we have to try to get to the hotel, which was another block. And they were shouting threats, you know, to us, to kill us, to hurt us. But they're also shouting, say her name, Breonna Taylor. And it's like, you couldn't reason with this mob, but I'm actually the author of the Breonna Taylor law to end no-knock raids. So the irony is lost on these idiots that they're trying to kill the person who's actually trying to get rid of no-knock raids. And they were shouting and screaming and just, it really, these people were unhinged. But I can't tell you how, I'm not sure we would have made it. So as we're walking, sort of surrounded by the police, they're attempting to push the police over to get to me. So at one point, they push a policeman backwards. He stumbles, and he's trying to catch his balance, and I catch the back of his flak jacket to stabilize him and, you know, make sure that he's okay because he's our defense. I mean, if he's down, the mob's loose on us. And you've seen the pictures of what they do to you. If the police are not there, if you defund the police, if we become Portland, if America becomes Portland, what's going to happen is people are going to be pummeled and kicked in the head and left senseless on the curb. That would have happened to us. I promise you, had we not had the D.C. police to support us, I mean, we are thankful that we have police.
Right.
And we've got to wake up. We can't have the whole country. We can't have Joe Biden rule the country and have no police. I mean, we can't walk down the street in D.C. safely now. That's how bad it is.
I saw one police officer was actually using his bicycle to keep the crowd back. He fell into you. You almost stumbled and fell down. You and your wife are both okay, right?
We are. We were unharmed, but, you know, it's still going on this morning. There are still mobs in the street blocking the streets. And I know it sounds like over the top to say that people are from out of town, but I think we're going to find out that these people are hired and from out of town. Specifically in our case, I believe there are going to be people who were involved with the attack on us that actually were paid to come here, are not from Washington, D.C., and are sort of paid to be anarchist.
Yeah.
This is disturbing because, really, if you're inciting a riot, that's a crime. But if you're paying someone to incite a riot, that person needs to go to jail as well. But we can't live this way. It's getting worse and worse. You know, I like being free to be able to walk out and go for a walk in the park. We cannot go outside now. It's become so dangerous for us. And I don't hear Joe Biden or Kamala Harris saying one thing about the violence. Yeah. This mob is their voters. This is the new Democrat Party. And if we don't resist this, United States is going to become Portland. We're going to become Chicago. All of these failed cities Democrats have run, the president said it in his speech. If we allow them to take over the White House, we are going to become Portland. The country will be on fire. We have to have law and order, and we have to support the police. Right. You know, I can't say that strong enough.
Senator, some of the papers today are reporting that what was being yelled at you was, as you said, say her name, Breonna Taylor. You know, you said there were obscenities. I would not like you to repeat those. But you said there were threats. Tell us what the threats were.
Well, the threats were to F you up, to, you know, to kill you. The threats were, if they could get hold of you, and I truly believe this with every fiber of my being, had they gotten at us, they would have gotten us to the ground. We might not have been killed. We might just have been injured by being kicked in the head or kicked in the stomach until we were senseless. You've seen the pictures. Most of the networks will not show the pictures of this. This is happening in all of our cities. It's got to stop. And thank God for the police. Had we not gotten to the police, I truly believe that the police saved our life, and we would not be here today, or we'd be in a hospital today had the police not been there. And I'd like to thank them if they're watching this. We thanked them last night, but it was still a melee. They were still trying to get people, mm-hmm. Away from us. Even in the hotel, people were following us into the hotel.
Well, let me ask you this as an exit question. Given the fact that you said that these people are still on the streets, protesters are still on the streets, and we heard from Griff Jenkins about a half an hour ago that apparently a number of the businesses in Washington, D.C. are boarded up because they're worried about trouble going forward. Does a prominent Republican, like yourself, somebody who is very recognizable, need to have security to simply walk on the streets of Washington, D.C., or major cities in America?
Probably yes, from now on. I don't feel it at home. At home, people are so friendly. I can go to the grocery store, and I want to live, the life of a normal person where I go to the grocery store and buy groceries or stop at the Minute Mart. And at home, I do feel that. But this also isn't normal. There's something going on here. This is like the FBI needs to be involved.
What do you mean something's going on? You've got a feeling. Tell us what you think.
My feeling is that there is interstate criminal traffic being paid for across state lines, but you won't know it unless you arrest them. Otherwise, you just think, oh, these are the, some normal hoodlums from a big city. I promise you that at least some of the members and the people who attacked us were not from D.C. They flew here in a plane. They've all got fresh new clothes, and they were paid to be here. It is a crime to do that, and it needs to be traced. The FBI needs to investigate, but the only way you can do it is you have to arrest people. And usually we say, oh, well, you didn't get hurt, so we're not going to arrest them. They were inciting a riot, and they would have killed us had the police not been there. They all need to be arrested, and I'm not saying forever, but they need to be arrested, questioned. They need to say, where are you staying? And the bills need to be subpoenaed by a judge to say, who paid for your bill? How did you get here on a plane and staying in a fancy hotel, and yet you're acting like a criminal? Something's going on here, and it's much bigger than people think. But the bottom line is, we can't let the United States become Portland. And that's what my fear is, that the United States is going to be on fire if we have no police. And look, I've been for reform. I've authored 22 criminal justice reforms. They were yelling at me, we're not going to let you go alive unless you'll say out loud you're for criminal justice reform. And I'm like, you idiot. You are so dense that you have no idea that I've been a leading advocate for criminal justice reform with President Obama, with President Trump, and you're going to try to kill me, and I've been trying to help the problems. And so this is what's sad, but it's such lawlessness. If we have this kind of lawlessness, I would say people are going to get killed. People have been killed. The former police chief, his story was so sorrowful to listen to his wife last night that was killed in St. Louis. Yeah. The little girl, Sakoria Turner, 8 years old, was shot in the middle of the day in Atlanta because they took a wrong turn. But they had let the mob take over a street corner armed. We can't let our cities be taken over by these marauders and thugs.
Well, we are glad you are safe, you and your wife, Kelly. And we thank you very much for coming on to tell us your story. Let's see what happens next. Let's see if there is some sort of an investigation or if it just disappears as he did right there. All right, Senator, thank you.
Rand Paul said it like it was. He was a sponsor of the Breonna Taylor Act, which cut off and stopped no-knock raids. So he's done all kinds of other crime-related bills, law enforcement crime-related bills too. These people that were after him the other night they have no idea what he's done. Anyway, coming up next is a clip from an interview that Martha McCallum had with Kellyanne Conway. She's really a fine lady, and she'd done the president a great, great deal of good. Here we go with that interview.
Kellyanne Conway has been by the president's side through thick and thin.
There is no den she will not go into. When my men are petrified to go on a certain network, I say, Kellyanne, would you do? Absolutely, no problem. Then she gets on and she just destroys them.
Tonight, she will address the convention before leaving her post at the White House. She's here to talk about that publicly tonight for the first time. She was the campaign manager in 2016, the first woman to lead a successful presidential campaign. And she had a long and successful career in conservative politics and polling before that.
I think you need to do is to get ready for a chyron that says President-elect Donald J. Trump. And I'll tell you what, listen, he told me to tell you that he'll come on your show as soon as he's elected.
One piece of advice I would give is don't pay attention to each other. Don't pay attention to the politicians. Don't pay attention to the elites. Pay attention to the people. This is a victory by the people.
We don't need Ukraine to help beat Joe Biden or any of the rest of them any more than we need Russia to beat Hillary Clinton.
Two new trade deals, two Supreme Court justices, two dead terrorists. That's two terms.
Kellyanne Conway, welcome. Good to have you here tonight, Kellyanne.
Thank you.
So I want to start with your thoughts on your departure and also what your message will be to the convention tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Martha. I wasn't aware we were going to talk about me, but let's do it. I have posted my message publicly and have gotten tremendous support from people right, left, and center and non-political people because they understand that we're mothers first, most important, best job, most wonderful job ever. And it has been such a wonderful ride for a boss and a president that's been so good to the women. You know, he's been elevating women in business and government on his campaign, in his corporation, in his cabinet for decades. And it's just been very natural. He lets us, he confides in us, consults us. And whether the men knew it or not or liked it or not, President Trump has always made sure that I and the other women here have been on equal footing with the men. But I told him on Sunday night in the Oval Office what I was doing, and I said, you know, for the next 2 months, you have to focus on winning, and I have to invest in leisure wear and hover over my kids as they hover over those computers doing school from home. So what I'm doing is what millions and millions of parents across this country are doing, Martha, which is trying to navigate this new not-so-normal where the kids are learning from home. And I want to be there for them. You know, during the spring, I was here every day, 7 days a week, when COVID-19 first hit and when we were, you know, working around the clock, and I didn't have the same opportunity that I want to have now to be there for them. But when the history books are written, I want people to remember it's Donald J. Trump who plucked me out of plain sight. I had been working for decades at this, and it was passed over by many people in the Old Boys Network and, frankly, the New Boys Network, and lots of those candidates lost. But he saw in me somebody who he wanted to help with his team, and it was a big team effort, and he and Vice President Pence won that election by going all across this country. But when people, you know, we have these handbooks that say women's empowerment, but it's only real if somebody lives it, if they walk it, if they actually promote women, yeah, not just talk about it, and he has done that.
I think it's a great point. You know, when I look back at the administration thus far, I think of you. You have outlasted every single wave of people leaving. And I think, you know, people want to know, why is that? How did you outlast everyone? And, you know, what does that say about the relationship that you have with the president, your boss?
I do have a great relationship with the president, and it's one that is very personal and hands-on meeting. I see these people leave the White House and write books about they were in this meeting and the president said that, and they said, and they, now they believe this. The time to do that is when you're here, because the president not just accepts but expects dissenting opinions and different backgrounds. He once said 2 years ago, and it's absolutely true, I like to watch them fight it out right in front of me. And we have done that because this is a man who wants people in front of him who come from different points of view, but then he weighs the consequences and the advice and eventually makes the decision. So for me, I think I've just always known that, first of all, I'm a staffer. I'm not the principal. Not everybody understood that. And also, there are two people in the building with their name on the ballot. It's Donald Trump and Mike Pence. They ultimately will make the decisions. But also, I think that in Washington, D.C., Martha, that people often overestimate how much you can or should get done by this Friday, and they totally underestimate how much you can and could get done in the next 2 weeks or 2 months.